Accession number 32297, reel 23.
John Dixon, reel 23.
Okay, so it's the big day, VJ Day as we now know it, VP Day as we called it then, and of course there were huge celebrations. The ship was anchored in Sydney Harbour. We were close enough inshore to hear all the fun and games that were going on. There were bands playing, there were ship sirens going. There was a huge party obviously going on, and we just couldn't wait to get ashore to join in all the fun. You can imagine what it was like. Anyway, we were told to clear lower deck, which basically means the whole ship's company gathers on the flight deck for a visit from the CNC, British Pacific Fleet, who was Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser, whose headquarters, of course, were in Sydney. So I can see him now, on he comes, and we're all wearing our short white uniforms, white shorts and shirts, and he's dressed similarly, if I remember rightly, and we are all gathered round, and we were fully expecting him to say, "Well done, lads, you know, the war's over. Off you go, you can have some leave," which is what everybody expected. But what he said was basically, "Well done, lads, you've worked hard, you've got yourselves into this situation, but you're sailing this afternoon." And we just could not believe what we were hearing. He said, "You won't be able to splice the main brace today, but you'll be able to splice the main brace at your next port of call." He didn't tell us where we were going. And it wasn't just our ship. I mean, I think Colossus and Venerable were with us still, and some cruisers. It was quite a big fleet. He said, "You're off this afternoon." Well, to say that there was a huge disappointment would be a complete understatement. We had one or two chaps of the ratings who were almost on the point of leaping over the side and swimming ashore to join the party, because you could easily have swum ashore, it wasn't that far. But they were all restrained, thank goodness. We just could not understand this. It made no sense whatsoever that we'd been spending all this time coming out there, and it all seemed very leisurely and no great urgency to get joined into the war or anything like that. And suddenly the war's over, and you've got to move, you've got to do this, that, and the other. So we did. We sailed out of Sydney on the afternoon of VJ Day. Moaning and groaning, it was awful. And we sailed at not exactly full speed, but we really moved, and we shot up the coast, and within a couple of days we dropped anchor at a place called Manus, M-A-N-U-S, which was in the Admiralty Islands. Now, it's a British possession, but the Americans, of course, had been there, and they laid out a complete naval base full of all luxury goodies and all sorts of things. But it was dreadful. It was like going back to Katakaranda. It was humid, it was hot. Monsoon type weather. And the ship got hot and stuffy. And we just thought of all the joy that was going on back in Sydney, and we didn't know why we were there. We dropped anchor. One of the ships, I think it was Colossus, she shot ahead and went. She didn't stay. She refueled and went. I think she went out to Shanghai. Venerable left very quickly. And it turned out that she went to Hong Kong pretty quickly, and we just stayed there for a week or 10 days. nobody quite knew. We were refueled, we were, the ships, we were resupplied, and it was awful. I went ashore with Robbie Burns, and we went to this American naval base where you could buy absolutely anything. It was like walking down Fifth Avenue. But I mean, there was nothing we really wanted to buy. We nearly got drowned. There was a huge monsoon while we were there, and we came back dripping like wet rats. But the Americans, and there were some American ships in there, they invited us on board and said, "Come on our ship, and you can have all the ice cream that you want." But of course, the American ships were dry. They didn't have booze on board, and all they really wanted was to be invited back onto our ships. Well, Robbie and I, we certainly didn't go to an American ship. Well, I don't think there was time or whatever. We didn't have the inclination, but we did invite, well, maybe not us, but I mean the ship did invite some American officers to come back on board us where they could have a drink. And I can remember this party, because the Americans, I mean, they can drink, can't they? And by golly, they did. We had a huge bar set up on the right at the stern of the flight deck, and I can see these chaps now, or one in particular, they'd come up the gangway, and they'd booze away, they'd really knock it back. And then before you could say anything, they'd leap off the flight deck. They'd just jump off into the sea. I seem to remember, I think we were only about 20, 30 feet, but it was, they leapt in. They'd swim round the stern of the ship to where the starboard after gangway was, which was always the officer's gangway, was the starboard. They'd come up there, all dripping. They'd salute the quarter deck as they came on board. They'd rush back up onto the flight deck. Another quick bellies, and they'd do it again. And they'd just go round and round. In the end, our ship's command just had to stop them. They had to be, one chap had to be physically restrained. They had to get the Marines to stop him. But they just went mad, because of the booze, you see. Anyway, that was just one party that we had, but we were absolutely bored out of our minds. They decided after a few days that the ship really needed airing because it was so hot and stuffy. We think, it may have not been true, they took the ship to sea to get some air through it, and they flew us off, and we were, believe it or not, we were loaded with 250-pound bombs. I think we carried four each of these bombs. And there was a rock. I think it was called, I don't know, it doesn't matter, Ping Chow or some rock or other. And we were told we could bomb this rock, which we did. We just flung all these bombs down. And we were told afterwards that really, we were only trying to clear the magazine in the ship to get rid of all the weapons, so that they could use that space to stock with other things. And what they were really stocking up with was proper sort of goods, goods for maintaining life and whatever, because eventually we did go to Hong Kong. But when we'd flown off the ship, we didn't go back on the ship. We went to a coral strip, which was another one of these monabs, called Ponam Island, and it was just a coral strip cut out of on this rock. And we were there for a day or two, having got rid of these bombs. Again, what did you do when you're bored out of your mind? There was nothing there, just a few grass huts. and one particular lot of aeroplanes I'll tell you in a minute, but we were there on this Ponam Island. We got bored to tears with swimming. You could swim as long as you wanted to in the lagoon there. But we thought, well, no, we've got a better idea. We collected these crabs, little land crabs, and we each had three or four of these, which we kept, and this was our racing stable. And we took them onto the beach, and we'd race these crabs, and we'd bet on them. And of course, all I can remember is I had a very good crab that I thought was going to win everything. But just as it was getting near the winning line, it suddenly buried itself. So that didn't count. But I mean, anything to keep amused, you see. Now, on this blooming place, Ponam, this was a monad. Now, a monad is mobile naval air base, and these were, I think there were six or eight of them. They were self-contained airfields. I mean, they'd got doctors, engineering staff, they'd got everything there, and they were just mobile. They were just transported to these various islands all around the Pacific and wherever. And they were so they became like a naval air station in miniature, but they'd got all the ancillary stuff that you needed, the support staff, and doctors and dentists and things like that. But the poor devils that were staffing them, they must have been round the twist, because they had absolutely nothing to do. It's like what's the American film, you know, about you haven't got anything to put on a good white suit for, you know, the American musical.
Oh, South Pacific.
South Pacific, you got it. It was just like that. So that was Ponam, but luckily we weren't there more than a few days. There was a squadron of the aircraft there. Volte Vengeance. Now, how many people have heard of a Volte Vengeance? These were a pretty dreadful American dive bombers. They weren't designed for the Navy. They were, but they were never, I think, much used in them for what they were designed for. But of course, our Navy had got some. And nobody knew quite what they were going to be used. They were used mainly for target towing and that sort of thing. And there was a squadron of these stuck on this place, Ponam. And what they did a useful job. They were given loads and loads of DDT, and they flew up and down spraying this stuff to kill off the mosquitoes. Now, I often think to myself, now, if I'd trained as a naval pilot, as I did, and ended my days spraying mosquitoes with DDT, I wouldn't have thought too much of it. But these poor chaps, this is what they did. I can't remember the name of the squadron, 776 or something, but how long they lasted and what sort of people they must have been to have been given a job like that, I have no idea. Anyway, thankfully we did get back on board, and we then did sail with some purpose in mind. We shot up through the Philippines, and it was absolutely wonderful. The scenery was gorgeous. We went up through the Philippines, and we eventually get to Hong Kong. And we drop anchor in Hong Kong on the 5th of September, and it was a magical place. I mean, it really is a lovely place, or it was then, before it's become a concrete city that it is now. But it was all lovely green hills and somewhat reminiscent of the Highlands of Scotland to look at. It was super. We're there. Venerable, by the way, had got there just before the end of August, so she was already established there. And we drop anchor on the 5th of September. This becomes another episode in my life, the time we spent in Hong Kong, which was from the 5th of September to the 28th of December. So we were there for, you know, 4 months. And it was a fascinating period of history, because, okay, the Japs had surrendered 3 weeks earlier, but nobody knew how many of them the Japs actually knew about this surrender, because they were all scattered around the new territories, some in the remote parts of Victoria Island, which of course is where Hong Kong City is, and nobody quite knew. It was a bit, the tension was still in the air, as it were. Anyway, the first afternoon we were there, we were allowed to go ashore. I don't think, not too many people were anxious to go to start with, I think, but there were three of us. I can't remember who the other two were. But we were wearing our short white uniforms, you know, white short sleeve shirts, shorts, and we were told that we should take revolvers with us, because you never knew. So we were each issued with a Smith and Wesson 0.38 revolver with 6 rounds of ammunition. Well, we just about knew how to fire them, but you know what a 0.38 revolver is. Not really a weapon of mass destruction, is it? So we go ashore onto Hong Kong Island, and it's absolute chaos there. The Americans had bombed the place before the war's end. It's a complete shambles. There's rubble in the streets. There are buildings without windows. And altogether, it was a pretty desolate place. Not quite as bad as I imagined what Dresden looked like, but it was bad. And these lovely, beautiful buildings, with pot marks, shell holes, and, you know, bomb splinter marks, and all sorts of things. Anyway, there we are. We're in the main square, which is, I think, called Victoria Square. I'm not sure now, but there we are, and we're just looking round, being nosy, and down the road comes this column of Japanese soldiers. There must have been a full platoon of them, or whatever. I would guess probably 60 of them, all marching, and they'd all got their rifles over their shoulders, and they were, well, you wouldn't say they were smart, but they were obviously a well-disciplined lot. No Japanese soldier looked smart, because they wore these peculiar baggy trousers and putty things, but they marched down there. And we were absolutely terrified. At least I was. I mean, we didn't know what their intentions were. I mean, okay, we'd won the war, but that, did they know that? And they marched along. My first inclination was to turn around and run. So I didn't like the look of this lot at all. But we stood our ground, and we thought, well, you know, British, we must stand here. So we stood there, and they came to a halt, and the officer in charge, I take it he was an officer, I didn't recognise any rank, but he came up, and he had his sword, and he offered his sword, not to me, but to one of the others. And we thought, well, what are we supposed to do with this, you see? Anyway, he couldn't understand us, we didn't understand him, nobody knew, so we indicated that he should put his sword on the ground with its hilt towards us, not the sword part, and then he was to make his troops put all their weapons on the ground, which they did, and then they were to go back, you know, about 10 paces away from their weapons, and sit down. Now, how we did this, or we weren't trained, or what, but this is what happened. I mean, they put their weapons on the ground, and they went and they sat down. we thought, well, what do we do now? We just stood there, you see, and there they were. We can't just leave them there. So the other chap, the third chap, said, well, we've got some sort of base set up just in the little harbour area, which was not far away from where we'd come ashore in the boat. He said, I'll nip back and tell them. So he went back, and fortunately on the way he met, whether he met a marine or not I don't know, but he met somebody who was able to summon a platoon of marines, whether they were from our ship I don't know, and the marines came and we scarpered, we left them to it. And so that was quite frightening. But that was our first run ashore.
So what were you doing in that period that you were there then?
Well, quite a bit happened. The first things I was quite amazed, because you know, when you're 20 years old, you've not seen much anything like this before. But we'd walk round the streets, and the big public buildings and the banks and those sort of buildings, they were all beautifully built, when they had great wide windowsills, rather like you probably see in London today, but big wide windowsill. And I couldn't understand why the Chinese, the coolies as we called them, would climb up onto these windowsills and would sleep there. Because they were, you know, they hadn't got any housing, so they would sleep on. And then somebody said to me, well, they're not asleep, are they? They're dead. And the Japanese, in the last few weeks of the war, they'd virtually starved the Chinese there. I don't know whether they deliberately did, or whether it was just that the supplies couldn't get to them. But these Chinese, the coolies, were desperate. They were thin, emaciated, they were, we'll talk about malnutrition, but they were in a very, very bad way. There was no medicine. And they were literally dying like flies in the streets. And this was 3 weeks after the war had ended. I'd never seen anything like this before. Eventually what happened was we did eventually get some transport, and I think it was mainly the Marines used to go round at night and sort of sweep these poor corpses up and take them off somewhere. I don't know what happened. But that was how it was when we first got there. Any captured Japanese, they were set about doing various tasks, and they, whenever they were being marched through the streets with our sailors, the Chinese would literally rush at them and start beating them. Now, you couldn't stop everyone. We tried to, but this was... Yeah, it was only a natural reaction, and of course we remembered what the Japanese had done to our prisoners, so, you know, it was a bit of tit for tat. And we used to get them, they were lined up near one of the camps in Hong Kong, where they put the Japanese, and they were lined up, and every morning when the Union Jack went up, we made them bow and get down on their knees in front of this Union Jack. But very quickly a message came down from on high: you must stop all this. All Japanese must be treated in accordance with the Geneva Convention, and they must be treated in a proper manner. Now, it was the most unpopular signal that we ever got, because we remembered what they'd done to our people. But when you look back on it, it was quite sensible. The Japanese a lot of them did commit harikari. It was their code. And when we rounded them up and got them into various camps, it was one of the jobs of our Marines was to go through their possessions, whatever they'd got, with a tooth comb and extract anything that they could use to take their own lives. But they somehow managed to do it, you know, they'd sharpen something and they'd... And nearly every morning there were two or three of them had committed harikari. It was sad. But you asked me what we did when we were there. Well, initially we were given jobs to do ashore. There was no flying. The ship, the aircraft stayed on the carrier. And we were given jobs to do ashore. There was no currency to start with. That created a bit of a joke because, I mean, I don't think cigarettes came into it in this situation, but what had happened, somewhere there was a warehouse, I don't know where or how, but the coolies had broken into this warehouse, and there were a lot of these expanding watch bracelets, do you know, the sort of thing, like an elasticated metal thing, which was what they were doing in this where, but the coolies had liberated all this lot, and these became sort of currency, because they were quite desirable things to have. And so they became a sort of currency. The actual Hong Kong dollar was reintroduced, I think, on about the 16th of September. So it wasn't that long after that. And the Chinese or people who were living there at the time, you'd be surprised. They'd buried their money in tin biscuit tins, and they were unearthing all this. And the old original Hong Kong dollar that was printed before the occupation, they were still good currency. It was still, you know, proper currency. So all these notes came out during the time of no currency. I had gone by myself to the Peninsula Hotel, which is, I think most people know, one of the top hotels in the world, and even then, of course, was quite a place. And in the basement of the hotel there were the usual facilities, gents facilities and all this, and there was the barber shop. So I thought, well, I need a haircut. So we went into this barber shop, and there's this Chinese barber, and he's got a white coat. I mean, yes, sir, you see. So he cut my hair for me, but there was no way I could pay him. So he was quite happy. I just signed a chip, one haircut, that's it. And all it was, this was his job before the occupation, and he wanted to make sure that he got his job back. So he was quite happy to go there with his scissors until he could be re-established properly. But he'd made his mark, he'd got there. And at the same time, in the hotel dining room, which was very, very posh, even then it had retained its sort of splendour, as it were, and it overlooked the harbour, and I had a table right in the window overlooking the harbour, and I ordered a lunch. Now, they could barely find anything. I don't know what it was they served me, but they found something. And I had this lunch and just signed a chit for it. I don't know whether those chits were ever honoured, but there we go.